It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Yes, indeed. It's the Jill on Money show. Welcome. So glad you are with us today. And I'm so delighted because I have to say the end of September, October, kind of like my favorite part of the year. If you get a chance, wherever you are listening, do come to New York in October. It is, I think, the very best month to visit New York. Mark, would you agree with that? 100%, Mark says. October. In fact, it's almost like anywhere you go in the world, October is pretty great. Anyway, you got a financial question? Gosh, we'd love to hear from you. We really would. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. And you can email us, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Now, I'm going to start the show by telling you that we have a unbelievable, fabulous, like over-the-top fabulous guest this show. It almost made me want to do the entire show with him, because he's a legend. And I'm going to tease it a little bit this hour because I love this guy so much. His name is Charles Ellis, also known as Charlie, but I have to get permission to call him Charlie, but I'm just saying Charles Ellis. He's really an institution in the world of investing. He's got a new book that's coming out called Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. Charlie is a guy who's like a total insider, you know, the guy who gave advice to all these big financial companies. His company, he founded a company called Greenwich Associates. He is going to explain to you why you have got to be the most insane investor if you think you're going to be beating the market, and why you are so much better off in low-cost index funds. He has been saying this for, 40 years. Yeah, 40 years since Vanguard launched its first index fund. But he'll tell you about his whole journey and why it is so much harder today to beat the market than it ever has been. And I think that's perhaps what like really got me so excited about the book, is that there's he's got a real way of telling a story, and he's got great experience. And you know, from my perspective, I can tell you these things. To hear the actual rationale, I think you're going to love it. So stay tuned. Second hour devoted to Charlie Ellis and why you need to get aboard and join the index revolution. All right. But first, let us start with a caller. And that first call honor goes to Kristen, who's calling from Kentucky. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to Jill on Money. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Fantastic. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm kind of curious about your recommendation. I'm in the process of making a career change, and I have both an IRA that's established, and I have the opportunity of also going to a new 401k. And what I'm trying to figure out is what to do with the old 401k. Do I roll it into my IRA, or do I roll it into the new 401k?
Excellent. And obviously, first of all, congratulations on making a change. It's always a fun thing. I'm sure you're a little nervous. What career are you moving into?
It's actually just a step up in the current career path. So it's kind of a promotion, but with a new company. So.
Fantastic. That's great. And how old are you, Kristen?
41.
And are you married, single, partnered?
Married.
And does spouse have a job and secure?
Yes.
Good. And in your mind, in terms of like long-term investing, you're comfortable managing your own money, or do you like, is somebody managing your IRA for you right now?
We have a fiduciary.
You do. Okay, great. That's awesome. How much money is in the old 401k?
I think it's about $77,000.
Okay. And where is that held? Which company?
Fidelity.
Fidelity. Okay, great. And the new 401k, do you know where they have their retirement accounts?
Mass Mutual.
Ding, ding, ding. Okay, you just gave me a big tell. And the fiduciary that manages your IRA right now, how much does he or she charge you?
I would have to go back and look. I don't have that in front of
maybe
me.
Maybe 1%, 1.5%?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, good.
Yes.
And how much money in total is the fiduciary managing?
Oh, gosh. Somewhere close to $200,000, I think.
Okay. Okay, great. Do you... okay. And this is so... I'm sorry, I'm like drilling down and ask you a zillion questions. So there's two pieces of this for me when I hear your story. Number one is... Okay, let's pretend the fiduciary didn't exist. If you just came to me and say, I have $77,000 at Fidelity in an old 401k. My new provider is Mass Mutual. What should I do? I would immediately say to you, stay at Fidelity. Because at Fidelity, you are going to have cheaper investment options than you're going to have inside of the Mass Mutual. Just absolutely positively. Chances are, Fidelity, you've got some index funds there. You got some low-cost managed funds there. But, you know, as long as you've got some index funds available, you stay there. You're in a slightly different situation because now I can't really tell you to – so I don't want you to roll into Mass Mutual because, again, it's likely that that's much – well, not much, but it's more expensive than Fidelity. On the other hand, if you're just going to take the $77,000 and give it to the fiduciary, there's a cost involved with that as well. So here's the thing. If you really like this person and hopefully what they're doing is managing your money and giving you financial planning advice, and that's why they're charging you 1 or 1.5% a year on your $200,000, go ahead and roll it over there because that's the whole reason you hired that person. If you're not exactly sure that you're getting if it's 1%, that's probably cheap for $200,000. 1.5%, that's different. There's also like a part of me that says $77,000, you're at Fidelity. You could just roll it into a brand new IRA at Fidelity and pick 2 or 3, 4 index funds and leave it there. So those are the options. Can you hang on for 1 second? I just want to come back and ask you a little bit more about the fiduciary, what he or she is doing for you, and make sure I want to kind of stick with this advice. But those are your basic options. Leave the old 401k at Fidelity. Just leave it there because you probably don't have to roll it. Open a new IRA rollover at Fidelity or roll it over to the fiduciary, which is going to cost you some extra money. So those are our three choices. Kristen, hang on the line, and we'll come back, and we'll find out from you what sounds more appealing or most appealing to you. How's that? Okay, you're listening to Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. So before we went to the break, we were talking to Kristen from Kentucky, and she's got an old 401k, and she's got a new job, and the new provider is Mass Mutual, the old provider Fidelity. So I outlined three different options for you, Kristen. One was just leave the money at Fidelity and choose some index funds that are still in your old 401k. The second would be to roll it over to your fiduciary financial advisor who's managing the money. And it's, you said it's probably 1 or 1.5% a year. And the third is to just actually open a new IRA rollover at Fidelity, roll that money over yourself, and manage it yourself. Then you save the management fee. So which of those three options appeals to you?
I kind of like the idea and never thought of it, of opening the new IRA with Fidelity and rolling it over. Because if I did that, there's still the option, if I changed my mind or felt like I wasn't managing it well enough, to roll it back into the other IRA.
Right.
Or no?
Right, okay. Absolutely. So it's there. The cool part about IRA rollover in general is that, you know, you do preserve the ability to move it, right, to roll it to something else. I guess that, you know, you're 41 years old. This is not rocket science per se, and so I don't know how it's invested right now. Do you manage it yourself, the 401k? Do you have a target date fund? Like, how is the, what are the investments inside of the Fidelity 401k right now?
They're pretty well dispersed. Across the board. You know, they're diversified, and I did run the options through the our fiduciary to make sure that he kind of liked what I had done.
Okay.
So, I don't have it right in front of me.
Yeah, it's okay.
Sorry about that.
You know, but, so my two cents is that if you're comfortable doing that, you kind of ran the asset allocation by the advisor. I think it's very easy. You can do it right at Fidelity. You literally can call them up and say, like, I just want to open up an IRA rollover. The money will flow in as cash. Okay. Then what I think is probably going to be your best bet is you take the allocation that you had, and then you fill up the categories with index funds. Meaning that if you had, for example, if you had said, oh, I'm choosing the large growth Fidelity growth fund, instead of doing that, then just do the S&P 500 or the extended market index. So just try to pick an index fund if you have any choice in the matter. So when you roll out of a 401k, you are going to have choice. And that choice should be the index fund simply because it's going to be the cheapest option. And if we're doing this kind of to save money on the management, why not pick an index fund? I think that's going to be your best bet.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the recommendation.
Fabulous. Good luck, and give us a holler back if you need some help with that allocation, okay?
Great, thanks.
Take care. All right, another happy person. I love that. You know, when you have a rollover, all of a sudden you're confronted with lots of choices. And what is kind of the thing to remember is that in many cases, you can leave the money where it is. Now, why would you do that? A lot of people say, well, why shouldn't I just have it myself? Well, sometimes big retirement plans have really great options. That's kind of cool. So, and many times you like your allocation. You don't want to mess with it. So keep it there. But I just have this like weird sense about the fiduciary who's managing their money. I don't know. Do you get a weird sense about that one, Mark? Do you get a little bit of like a, maybe she doesn't trust him exactly 100%? I got that too. Something going on there, maybe. Not sure what. And it could be completely off the mark. I got a weird little vibe-ish. And also, isn't it telling that if like you loved your advisor who was giving you completely tons of fabulous financial advice, you would just want that person to manage all your money? Mark wants to know, if you're rolling over a 401k, should you convert it to a Roth now? Oh, you know, that's a good question. The answer is usually a conversion makes sense if you have the money to pay the taxes. And, you know, remember, she converts that sucker. She gets $77,000 of taxable income. She could spread it out. She could do a little bit at a time. Possible. Not a bad idea, Mark. You're catching on to this. But most people don't have that. Alice writes that she and her husband are late 70s, early 80s. And they've had a financial advisor. Well, I'm not sure it's an advisor, but she says, we have been under the care of a firm located where we once lived. Now, many brokerage firms have contacted us to switch to their companies. However, we don't know who we can trust. Should we stay with our current company? Do we seek another advisor from another company? She wants to know, is it possible that someone can review and render an impartial assessment of our portfolio? Someone who is not affiliated with a particular company, like a UBS, a Wells Fargo, a Merrill Lynch, a Morgan Stanley. We want to know whether our current holdings are strong or why our holdings have stagnated. Why has our portfolio stayed in one place for 17 years? We are willing to pay for this service. So that's an interesting question. First of all, I don't know that it seems odd that your portfolio would stay still for 17 years. I guess it's possible. I mean, I wonder if maybe have you been taking money out or not? I don't know, but let's get to the basic question. How do you get an impartial review of your holdings? How do you get that? And it's hard because, you know, in some respects, anyone who looks at that kind of wants a piece of your action. So, you know, you start by saying, all right, let's hopefully get to someone who's impartial, right? And maybe the way you do that is you pay a fee to somebody and you do it like as a fee for service. Like, I will pay you by the hour to conduct this analysis. And the way that you might find somebody to do that is to consult with the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, or NAPFA. And maybe by going to NAPFA, what you can find is somebody who is really set up to bill you on an hourly basis, conduct this analysis, and then be happy with you to just walk away. You see, again, depending on who you might find, that advisor, even if that person is a fiduciary, may find a way to try to sort of get the assets to him or her. So I'm hopeful that if you get to a NAPFA advisor and you get somebody who really does this, and you should be very upfront. We have no interest in moving our assets. We simply just want another set of eyes on this. And then you decide what to do. So that's my suggestion. And maybe you'll be pleasantly surprised. Maybe what I'm hoping for, like I got a question recently from somebody who said, could you look at my portfolio? Why is it just the exact same amount of money? It's the same. It was fine. It's the same $4 million every single month. I said, you realize you're taking out $15,000 a month, right? Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. That's not a portfolio that's standing still, right? You're listening to Jill on Money. Go to NAPFA.org. You can check it out. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back.
Annuities, IRAs, 401ks, she covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL, that is our phone number. You can email us, askjill@jillonmoney.com. And we love to hear from people who've been in touch with the show, you know, and we always invite you to come back on. Which I believe is a situation of Jack, who is calling from Texas. Is that right, Jack? We've talked to you before, right?
Yeah, more or less. We went through emails before. It's my first time to actually talk to you.
Are you nervous?
A little bit. Do I sound nervous?
No, you sound great. You sound fantastic. So we warmed you up. We got you. And then Mark said, no, stop emailing us. Come on the show, which I'm delighted that you're doing. So, Jack, what is on your mind? How can I help you?
I got a question about my kids' 529 plans.
Okay.
Basically, my wife and I's parents, they gave us some really nice gifts of setting up some 529 plans for our kids, who are about 1 and 3.
Okay.
So my kind of the question is that they set it up through like their broker or whoever, the Raymond James company.
Yep.
But, you know, I've done a lot of reading online and just through listening to your show and stuff. And it sounds like I could also, like instead of doing it through that manager, I could go to a 529 plan directly.
Correct. Now, let me ask a couple of questions. Number one, how are these plans titled? Is it your in-law's name and the kids are the beneficiary, or is it in your wife or your name and the kids are the beneficiary? Which way?
That is a good question.
Ah, here's why I'm asking. A couple of things. Number one is, if it's in your name, it's very easy to do it, right? You can, and so, you know, when you buy a 529 plan through an advisor, you are simply doing what is kind of the, I say, like, easy thing to do, right? Like, just have my guy, have my gal do it, right? And you pay more to have that done. Now, maybe your in-laws, who, like you said, so generous, awesome, that they've set these plans up, maybe that's right. Kind of what they did. They were like, oh, we got the guy already. Let the guy do it. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's, so the two different choices would be, if they titled it with, let's just, I'm going to say, like, mom-in-law is the owner of the account, one-year-old child is the beneficiary, then you're going to have to convince your in-laws to make the change, right? Because okay. It's not in your name. Now, you might say, yeah. You'll do all the work or whatever, but I'm just saying that is a slightly different wrinkle in the process than if... Sure. If it's in your name or your wife's name. Now, let's pretend it's in your wife's name. And they just said, set it up in my daughter's name. And each kid gets an account. And it's set up right now with which plan? You said Virginia?
Yeah. Oh. It looks like the Virginia plan.
Okay. And we'd like to move it to another plan, a cheaper plan. And, you know, if you look at, you know, all the different plans that are out there, lots of different options. If you're out of state, the biggies that I like, and even Morningstar kind of ranked them as really good plans, there are four different ones that are pretty good. Nevada, Utah, Alaska, and Maryland. Those four tend to be the really good plans for out-of-staters. And the reason is not because those states are so much better. It's just that they are working with plan providers that offer the very cheapest fees. So, okay, so if it's in your name, no sweat, right? Piece of cake. If it's in your in-law's name, a little bit better. Now, Mark is texting me immediately, IMing me, and saying, what about New York? They use Vanguard. New York is also good. New York happens to be a much better deal if you are an in-state New Yorker. So calm down, Mark. You know why Mark's asking about that? Because I had him set up 529 plans for his niece, nephew, or his sister's kids, and now he wants to make sure that I didn't screw him in giving him bad advice. But I'm just telling you, the four highest rating Morningstar, and New York is a very highly rated. You're not going to go wrong using New York, but I'm just saying, I think in the Morningstar ratings from last year, and they'll probably update them at the end of this year, the top four, if I recall, I'm pretty sure, it's Nevada, Utah, Alaska, and Maryland. And so it's really the states that are using cheap funds, like they're using Vanguard or maybe they're using T. Rowe Price. So I say those are the choices. And, you know, I don't know. How do you feel about talking to your in-laws about this? Is this going to be like a weird combo?
It could be a little weird, but, you know, I think it could be worthwhile in the long run.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that, you know, as I said, if it's, let's say it's in their names, then I think what you get to do is say, look, I don't want to, I'm so, don't forget to be like, we're so grateful. We're so, you know, like really pour it on because you are. But, you know, what you're really saying is if we can save 0.5% a year, that will drop right down to the bottom line for the kids' education.
Right.
Because you're not
getting
it. That's the way to present it. So I say go for it.
Yeah. All right. Great.
All right. Any other financial things going on in your life?
Nothing other than that. I just wanted to clarify. So there's no, like, I don't know, extra expenses for these 529s being out of state type thing?
No, there is not. There are very specific rules on titling. So just make sure. That's why I also asked about, like, whose name is the account in. But there should be no charge to do it. I think it's, many plans will let you do it like once a year, but you know, you'll check the rules. I think first thing is you can go look at the Nevada, Utah, Alaska, and Maryland plans, or just Google like Morningstar best 529 plans. You'll see what I'm talking about. They have a comprehensive list, and do a little investigation before you have the conversation with the in-laws. So you have all the information you need and present it. And hopefully you save yourself this 0.5% a year, which I think is great. So, Jack, you did fantastic for your first call. I think you'll be back. Give us a holler if you need more help. It is Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Give us a holler. We'd love to have you on the air. Or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Want to get in touch? Call or email any day, anytime. 855-411-JILL or ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. Just because you
find yourself. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Here we go. Ready? 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. We got an email from somebody who said, please don't use my name or my email, so I won't do that. So let's just say that she is a 61-year-old and has worked enough to collect her own Social Security. Her husband turned 62 in January, decided to retire. We are lucky to be comfortable with his two pensions, our investments, and savings. We owe no money. Our home, we owe no money. Our home is owned free and clear. No loans. Our children are married. They're on their own. My husband wants me to apply for Social Security when I turn 62. I never had a great job, so my check wouldn't be a huge amount. Since we don't need the money, I think I should wait until he files at age 66 and collect half of his check. He thinks I should not wait. He will be getting the maximum amount. What's your advice? Jenny, I think you're right. You know, you can run some calculations. Here's when you're going to be wrong. If you are unlucky and die early, then that is, he will be right. But, you know, presuming that you are in good health, and presuming that, you know, you will live longer than he will, right, because you've got a longer life expectancy, I think it's fair to say that statistically, you will likely be better off waiting, especially because you don't need the money. You know, so the time when it makes sense to apply early at 62 is when you are willing, you basically have no other options. Like, I apply, I'm getting Social Security because I can't possibly pay my bills without that Social Security. That said, that's not where you are. And remember, the biggest mistake, we've had so many Social Security experts on this show. What is the number one mistake that people make with their Social Security. It's not that they, missed this great window of opportunity about when to file for the fancy strategies because they're all gone now. The biggest mistake people make, they file Social Security for retirement benefits early. And in doing so, they see a permanent reduction in their benefit. So why would you do that? You're far better off getting half of your husband's. That is actually a bigger amount. And, even if, let's just say you were single. Let's just even play this out a little bit. Forgetting about your husband. Let's say that you turned 62 and you can collect your benefit, but you don't need it. So what do you gain by waiting till your full retirement age? Well, you gain some flexibility about, some cool things down the line if you ever wanted to change your mind about something. But what you're really gaining is a higher benefit for the rest of your life. And we also know that if you've got longevity and you wait until you're 70, you're going to max out your benefit. And that is going to amount to something like 8% annually of increased benefits. I don't know where you're getting an 8% guaranteed return, so I'll take that. Thank you very much. The rule of thumb with Social Security is that if you are in good health and you can wait, you should wait. So there you have it, Jenny. Don't get me in trouble with your husband, though. I don't want to get some angry call. I wrote an article about debt, and I will absolutely send it in, send it up onto the show notes for this week. And we got some really amazing feedback on that. One of the things that's interesting that we've been talking about is that student loan debt is different than, say, auto debt or the mortgage debt bubble. But a couple of people wrote in and said to me, student loan debt is so different because it can last until you die, except for rare instances, student loan debt can't be discharged with bankruptcy. Absolutely true. Right? And, one of the things that we should also know that with an auto loan or auto debt, it's something that can be repossessed quickly. So there are many reasons why not all debt is created equal, but I should point out that and remind people that most student debt cannot be forgiven in bankruptcy while mortgages can. And so the big question is whether that student loan debt is going to create some sort of crisis. I don't think so, in general, but that's just me because the government holds most of this debt. So in my mind, it's kind of hard to make the argument that you're going to have an industry that's going to go under when it's really mostly backed by the government. So there you have it. I will post that article so you can check it out. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Ron writes, I turned 70 and a half this year. I've got a 401k through my employer, but I am still working. What are my minimum distribution requirements for tax purposes? So what did I do? I went to my boy Ed Slott, retirement expert, who says that he gets this question frequently. So here's the deal. If you are participating in a retirement plan where you work, and if the plan allows, that's the key. You ready? If the plan allows, you don't have to take any RMD from that plan until the year you retire. If you own 5% or more of the company, you have to take a required minimum distribution. These rules apply to most employer plans. If the plan's a SEP or a simple, you've got to take the RMD because those are IRA-based. From any plan where you are required to take a distribution, you can continue to make contributions as long as the plan allows. No exception for IRAs. Once you actually are at your 70 and a half, the year you turn 70 and a half, from an IRA, you've got to take an RMD. Okay? So that's good news. If you are so many people continuing to work well into their 70s, if you work at a big company and you've got a 401k plan, you may find that you don't have to take that distribution. And that's just a huge benefit. So what I would say, Ron, is check with the plan. There's no RMD on a Roth, Mark. Mark's asking me, is there a required minimum distribution on a Roth? No RMD on a Roth. I'm sorry there. You know, like I digress because I saw Mark just pick up. Anyway, let me just do one other thing around this. When you do finally retire, you do have a distribution for the year in which you stop working. Okay? Just remember that. I'll link to Ed's article about this, which is very good. Okay, stay tuned. You are in for a huge, huge treat. Legendary investment guru Charlie Ellis. He is our guest next on the Jill on Money Show. If you got a question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
You're back. It's hour number two of Jill on Money, and we are very privileged today because we have a special guest, the legendary investor, investment advisor, and all-around good guy, Mr. Charles Ellis, also known as Charlie.
Please.
When I first met him, I said, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Ellis," and immediately you said, "Call me Charlie." I like that.
Well, beautiful women get you in that right direction anyway. So let's
thank God it's radio. All right. Let me just do a tiny bit of your bio because I do want you to tell a little bit of your story. But the reason that Charlie is joining us today is he's got a brand new book out. Is this your 14th or 15th or 115th book?
This is the 18th.
18th. Hi. It's very lucky. So what's amazing to me is that this investor legend has written a book that is probably the most succinct and best case for using indexes rather than managed funds. It's called Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. It's very American. It's draped with a flag and a fife and drum, and it's time for the index revolution to take hold. So, Charlie, you went to Yale. I've heard of that.
I majored in art history to prepare myself.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, that's good to know. An MBA from that place in Cambridge.
Harvard Business School.
No, okay. Also a PhD from NYU.
Yes.
That seems unnecessary. Also a CFA charter in 1969. Many articles. You founded Greenwich Associates, a big consulting firm to the investment business and industry.
Right.
And so the thing that's kind of fascinating to me is that here you are, this great advocate of using index funds, but this is not your training. You came out of the CFA program,
right,
which is, you should be a stock picker, right?
That would be the expectation.
And what year did you begin your career as a CFA, as somebody who would like start the process of analyzing stocks? And how did that work out for you?
Started as an analyst in 1963.
Okay.
And then I got a CFA about 4 or 5 years after that, although I had to wait a year until I was old enough to qualify on one of the criteria that was used in those days.
And you did you just love it? You were an art history major, but how did you get involved in the industry to begin with?
I had a crush on a really good-looking girl who said to me, are you going to go to the B school? And I said, what's a B school? And she said, it's a business school, the business school. The business school. Which one is that? She said, oh, for goodness sake, the Harvard Business School.
Yeah.
So I made an application to the Harvard Business School.
Now, that's interesting. Did you marry that person?
No,
you
but
found
we're
someone
still
else?
Very good friends.
Oh, okay. Just want to make sure. And when you went to Harvard Business School, what'd you think? I mean, you hear you're an art history major.
Well, I thought as long as you could remember debits on the left, you'd be okay. And I had a wonderful time. It was a fabulous educational experience. But the fun thing there is that the only course on investment management at all on investment management was called cheerfully Darkness at Noon. The reason for that is it started at 11:30, went to 1 o'clock. And it was a tremendously boring course with a very dull and boring professor. And instead of 80 or 85 students, it had 15, maybe 20 in a big year. And it was all about the detailed administration of the trusts of the Hilda Heald family.
Mm-hmm.
And it was boring. So I and everybody else that I knew skipped that class. So we came out of the Harvard Business School knowing nothing
really?
At all about investment management.
And so then, so what was your first job out of Harvard Business School?
Started in a very, very nice place, tiny little office, managing investments for the Rockefeller family.
Oh, that's a good client.
It was a fabulous experience. They were not only their own personal fortunes, but also the endowments that they had created. So Rockefeller University, Colonial Williamsburg, and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and a couple of others.
And what did you learn when you were there? What was your first impression of how one manages wealth?
What I learned first was I didn't belong where I was. I didn't know how to do any of the things that were being done. And my immediate supervisor told me, he said, Jolly, look, the Rockefellers are really wealthy people. They can't afford you.
And so, wait a second. So how'd you get the job to begin with then if you didn't know what you were doing? You knew someone who knew someone?
No. A man who was working in that small office wanted to have an assistant that would work with him. And he passed word to the business school they were looking for someone. I got the word because I didn't have a job yet. He and I met. Half an hour later, I realized this guy really could teach me a lot, and I've got a lot to learn. I better find out what he does for a living because I don't really quite understand. I thought it was the Rockefeller Foundation, which it was not. In the second half hour, I realized it's about investment management. I didn't have anything against investment management, but I knew I could learn a lot from him. So when he said, well, would you like to join us? I said, yes.
That was a pretty big leap of faith, actually.
Well, it was a bigger leap of faith than you might think because I forgot to ask him how much he was going to pay.
So your boss is like, you don't know anything. So what does he say? Go get more education?
Yeah. Sent me to NYU Night School.
Uh-huh.
And I started taking classes. Fortunately, when I got there to sign up, there were a whole bunch of students hanging around in lines to register. Mm. And I got in one of the lines because I'd been in the Army. I know how to get in lines. And we got to the front of the line. And this really attractive young woman looked up and said, you're next. Special student or regular student? I said, I'm sorry, ma'am. I don't know the difference. She said, well, regular students taking courses. Special students just taking a course. Regular student taking courses towards a degree. What was your last degree? I said, I got an MBA from Harvard Business School. Oh, she said, Harvard Business School. That's exciting. You should be in our PhD program. Well, my sister and my brother had always gotten higher grades than I had, so I figured, fine, sign me up. Does it cost more? And she said, no, it's the same price, and you can always drop out if you want to.
And that's how you decided to get a PhD. So basically, attractive women have been very important in your career.
They certainly have been important in my life.
I've been very, very lucky. That's good to know. You do the CFA, and at some point you've got to that you like this, right?
It's easy to find out you like investing. It's like the longest continuous game with the most interesting players, and the rules are not specified, but there are a lot of guidelines, and then there's lots of information, and every day you can measure how you're doing.
So we're talking to Charlie Ellis, who is the author of a new book called The Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. Charlie, when we come back, I want to kind of move into the next phase of your career, which is really once you get all of this education and you finally perhaps feel at least entitled to have a seat at the table where you can start looking at stocks and analyzing what would be a good investment. What I want to understand is that, say, in the late 60s and the 70s, why people could seemingly beat the market then fairly easily. Not today, but then, I shouldn't say easily, but with some work.
With a high degree of reliability, it was fairly easy, very interesting, and you could do it.
When we come back, more with our guest, investment legend, Charlie Ellis. Is that a good title? Investment legend? That's pretty good. I like it. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Want to get in touch? Call or email any day, anytime, 855-411-JILL or ask Jill at jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 855-411-JILL. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. I'm not looking at the email, though, and I'm not answering the phone because when you have someone as smart and legendary as investor Charlie Ellis in your midst, live in the studio, then you pay full attention. Charlie has a new book, his 18th. It's called Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. And by the way, if you miss any part of this interview, you can go online to jillonmoney.com. You can listen to it after. Don't freak out. Don't sit in the parking lot listening to this. You will make this available. Charlie, you had an interesting first, say, 5-8 years in the industry. You become a CFA charter. You finish with the Rockefellers. You go to a firm called Donaldson, Lufkin & Jenrette, or DLJ. And at that time, you write, 50 years ago, active investors could realistically aim to outperform the market, often by substantial margins. How come? How come you could do it then?
Well, if you go back 50 years ago, it's hard to believe today, but if you go back 50 years ago, trading on the New York Stock Exchange was between 3 and 4 million shares. Now it's 100 times that, or 1,000 times that. 90% of the trading was done by individuals who made a purchase of a stock every year or two. Half the time it was AT&T that they bought. They didn't know anything about what was going inside the stock market. They were outsiders. That was your competition. And your opportunities were you could go to any company and say, I'd like to talk to chief executive, chief financial officer, the treasurer, and three of the operating unit heads, and I'd like to ask them some very penetrating questions, and I would expect them to give me straight answers to all the things that I asked them about. And if you would go out to Chillicothe or wherever and ask those questions, you would get really good answers. And the result was you could get competitive information. It was terrific. If you didn't want to do it yourself, there were new firms being formed to do the research for institutional investors. DLJ was one of 10 different firms that were formed about that same time. They were filled with people who had also gotten an MBA, really serious about business, who would go out and do that kind of research and gather the information and write 30, 40, 50, 60-page reports explaining the whole thing to you so that you could read that and then go out and ask your own questions in addition. So it's not very hard to get a competitive advantage over the competition since the competition didn't know very much at all.
And in that time, you know, my grandfather was the chairman of a publicly traded company. And I used to tease him and I would say, oh, you know why you guys made all that money? Because you were all on each other's boards and you all traded on insider information and you all knew everything. And he would laugh and he said, we didn't conduct ourselves that way. We really and he was very serious. He was sort of this very genteel guy. And I'm wondering, like when you say 90% of the trading was done by individuals, were those only wealthy individuals, or were there more run-of-the-mill people in the 60s and 70s buying stocks?
Doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, business people, probably be the top 15 or 20% of the population that was able to save money in those days, or some of them would be just getting started with mutual funds. Mutual funds have really flourished since then, but back then, some people were buying mutual funds as a sensible way to invest.
And when do you think the shift started? When did it become, when did all this information become much more pervasive, ergo the research analyst didn't quite have the edge that he or she once had?
Well, let me put it this way. Summer turns to winter kind of gradually.
Mm-hmm.
Rather definitely, but there's sometimes, like today is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a little bit colder,
mm-hmm.
sooner than you expected. So there's a little bumpiness in the data,
mm-hmm.
but it does inevitably happen. And what was going on is increasingly more and more people were getting the information
mm-hmm.
and getting the assets to be responsible for. Mutual funds were growing. Pension funds were shifting from mostly bonds to mostly stocks. And they were increasingly active in the way in which they managed, because you could increase the profitability of the assets, and that meant lower contributions to the pension fund, and that meant higher earnings for the company, and all these things are very, very nice.
And you started Greenwich Associates in the early 70s, 72?
Yep, 72.
And what was the purpose of that company?
Basic idea was the people who are buying investment and financial services of all kinds, banking, investment banking, bond dealing, and so on, really were looking to be sure they're improving the suppliers' skills at doing what they wanted. And the suppliers, honestly, had no idea how to do better.
Uh-huh.
So if they could get information about what they could do better and how were they doing compared to their competition, then they would be able to think through and develop a more effective strategy.
At some point, you delivered a paper that, or you wrote an article, I can't remember which it was, because now it's like escaping me, where you sort of introduced this idea that this thing, an index fund, which was introduced almost exactly 40 years ago, may actually be preferable to all the time, money, and energy spent on the active analyst who goes out and kind of combs the investment landscape. When did you write that originally?
1970s.
Why did you write that?
Because I was privileged to see an awful lot of different investment institutions, and each one of them knew that they were smart and had wonderful people in their organization, but they weren't paying attention to the reality that all the other institutions were also filled with really smart people who were doing very good work and very determined to compete and succeed. And that if you looked at the data on how were the institutions doing, increasing numbers of them were falling short of their own objective or what they promised their clients they would do.
And so you write this in the early 70s, and yet, I mean, it would seem to me that still in the 70s, there was an edge still.
Very definitely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So you were a little bit before your time, but you're starting to get some empirical data, and it's waking you up a little bit. It's like a religious awakening, right?
Yep.
It's like, okay, I'm feeling it. And when is it that you start to say to yourself, wait a second, This old game, the edge, seems to really be going away? Maybe I was onto something in the early 70s.
Yeah, the best protection against learning is an easy ability to forget. because I was working with Greenwich Associates, I had the data on who was best in 1972, who was best in 1973, who was best in 1970, who was best in 1975, and so on and so on and so on. And you couldn't miss the unbelievable, stunning reality that the best investment managers in the early 70s, more and more of them were missing as you get farther and farther out into the middle and late 70s. And by the time you get to the early 80s, most of those who were top drawer in the early 70s were gone.
That's interesting.
And then if you take those early 80s, even faster, they got deleted by the early 90s. So you're looking at the data, and nobody was paying attention to it, because they were all talking about who's latest and greatest and who's best now. But if you record the history, there it was standing in front of you.
And what's fascinating is just from a timing perspective, you're saying that outperformance starts to narrow into the 80s, but yet right at that moment, 1982, the beginning of that bull market, right through 1999. So it's kind of fascinating to me that that's the moment where people are maybe not even realizing how much they're paying in fees, how much better they could be doing had they just been in an index fund, and probably not till after the fact, and we look back to see that data. So when we come back, Charlie, I do want to dive into some of the numbers a little bit with you and have you present the case.
Great, because there are two big forces and they ought to be looked at separately.
Excellent. We are talking to Charlie Ellis. He is the author of The Index Revolution. Are you going to join the revolution? You will by the end of this interview, I promise you. It's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
K, IRAs, refinancing. She covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. I can feel the
dawn. I can feel the... You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. And we are delighted to have Charlie Ellis, legendary investor, advisor, guru, with us. Charlie's 18th book is called Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. And before we went to the break, we were talking a little bit about kind of the funny timing where it seemed that really smart people, analysts, were able to beat the market in the 60s and the 70s. But by the beginning of the 80s, you were noticing at your firm, Greenwich Associates, that all of a sudden the guys and gals who were doing really well in the past two decades disappearing. And so the concept
of... The only thing I differed wasn't all of a sudden. It was gradually,
gradually,
unrelentingly more and more.
That it was just like the numbers were obvious.
Yep.
It started to become obvious.
If you looked at them.
And during the break, I just said to Charlie, I said, the dangerous two words that you always get when you present data to even very smart people, you present all this information and they'll say, yeah, but. And so I presume that you would talk to people and you would say, maybe we start looking at just buying an index fund, which started, again, 40 years ago. And they'll say, yeah, but my guy, my hedge fund guy, my this guy, my active this guy, he does better. What did you do in that moment?
You have to be patient and wait for the data to accumulate. Most people still won't be looking at it because they'd be looking at the last few years and they're saying, yeah, but I changed from that guy. Or, yeah, but I'm doing things differently now. Yeah, but my guy's coming back. It just had a tough time. Yeah, but.
Yeah, but. It's the worst. Two terrible words. One of the issues that index investing may have run into, like a roadblock, is that it became known as passive investing. What's the problem with being passive?
Well, if you're an engineer, you see passive as being a perfectly sensible term to describe a particular reality. But have you ever thought about, this is my husband, he's passive?
Mm.
Or this is my candidate for president of the United States, she's passive?
Yeah, you don't want that. You want active.
Would you like to be described by anybody as passive?
I tell you
Certainly
what,
not.
I guess that I might want to, it seems like, because it would be so odd.
It would be a marvelous entertainment. Passive is one of those subliminal negative words, like low energy.
Mm-hmm.
You knocked a guy right out of the candidacy for the Republican, probably the most qualified individual in the group. Low energy, that was the end of that.
Right, gone. So if we peel back the onion a little bit on the index revolution, now fast forward, because you said that when you first entered the business, you could reliably beat the market. Why is it so hard for these geniuses who come out of Stanford, and they're no longer, by the way, they're not art history majors or international relations or English majors like us. They are quants. They are super brilliant. Yep. They've got their algorithms. Why can't they beat the market?
Only one reason.
Why?
The market is being created by people just like them. Mm. And if you go back to when I got in the investment management business, worldwide there might have been as many as 5,000 people who were involved in trying to figure out prices and beat the market. Now there are at least 1 million people worldwide who are trying to figure out the market. I'll give you an example. I went to Vietnam. I go to Vietnam quite a lot over the last 10 years. Went to Vietnam for the CFA Institute to present the charters to people in Vietnam who had become CFAs. This is a communist country. Mm-hmm. They've only had a stock market for 3 years, and it's a call market, not a continuous auction market. And these are people who have, in 3 years of examinations, qualified for this really difficult certification. There were 29 of them in what we call Ho Chi Minh City, and they call Saigon.
Right. They also, I also learned from my nephew who was there over the summer that they also call it the American War, not the Vietnam War. I didn't know that. Instead of you're there.
They also don't know that after the American War, as they call it, they had one hell of a fight with the Chinese.
Yeah, right. Mm.
Again.
Yeah. So at this point, is there any argument to be buying an actively managed mutual fund or to hire some hedge fund person who does seem to be able to beat the market from time to time? Is there an argument to do that?
Sure. And there are two parts to the argument. One part is baloney and one part is accurate.
Okay. Let's do baloney first.
Well, let me do accurate
All
first
right.
because baloney takes longer.
Okay.
Accurate is there are some few people who are so proficient at advanced mathematics that they're able to tease out of what's going on in the marketplace measures by which they can be slightly better than the market.
Okay.
And there are some people who are not in the active market the next year or two or three, but they're thinking in terms of 10 and 15 years and to do such really remarkable fundamental research that they make really right decisions for the long term. Obvious individual as an illustration is Warren Buffett,
right,
who's had a wonderful record by thinking longer and deeper than most others do.
Mm-hmm.
Never perfect, but real advantage.
Mm-hmm. What's the baloney?
The baloney part is more to do with what you were saying earlier. This time it's different, or mm-hmm. so on and so on. It is hard not to believe that if you work hard, and you do what you're supposed to do, and you get your homework done, you won't be successful. After all, we were taught that when we were in grade school, in grammar school, in high school, in college,
mm-hmm.
and that's how we go back and think, yeah, I know darn well why that person graduated Phi Beta Kappa. They grinded out and they worked hard all the time. I know why that guy was so good at tennis. He practiced all the time. I know why that guy got an advancement in the job. He was constantly putting in time and effort and so on and so on. We've grown up thinking the little engine that could, all the different mythology, try harder, do better. What we forget is it do better than whom?
And we're going to get right back to that because we're going to say who better than the market. We don't have to do better. We can just buy the market. It's so beautiful. It's so easy. It's so simple. It can't be that simple. Maybe it is. We are talking to Charlie Ellis, the author of The Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. More with Charlie when we return.
It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Back to Jill on Money.
You're back with Jill on Money. We are here with investment legend, You are an investment in and of yourself, Mr. Charlie Ellis. It is delightful to have you here with us, live in the studio, author of The Index Revolution. I feel like I want to buy the whole Charlie Ellis library. I could be like, you know, buying 18 books at once. I could give you a whole part of my own bookshelf. I still actually have bookshelves. Charlie, before we went to the break, we were talking about how, you know, there's this notion that people believe they can beat the market. They can be active. They're smarter. Their guy's better. This guy's better. But at the end of the day, when you factor in the costs associated with these actively managed funds or hedge funds, the tax liability, it sort of seems impossible to beat it anyway. But let's just pretend, let's wipe that clean. Let's say that all things being equal, exact same fees, would the numbers be as drastically different? Would indexes still beat the active over time?
Just barely. But when you add in the fees, it's a table thumper.
Okay.
And when you get a 15 to 20% return market, who cares about the difference between 1% and 1/10 of 1% fee? But when you got a 6 or 7% return market, all of a sudden that starts to become interesting because it's 1% of the assets you already have. So if you do it as what's the manager going to do for me? Returns, okay. So as a percentage of 7% returns, just to be on the high side, it's a 15% fee. Mm. One is a fraction of 7. And then if you say, well, actually, I can get the commodity product for 1/10 of 1%. So I'm paying up for something. What am I getting for paying up? Actually, you're getting less, not more. So the fee goes to infinity.
Oh, my gosh.
It's the only service there's ever been where the fee is infinite and the people providing the service are admired and paid wonderfully well.
And for underperforming every single year, basically. And then we know that we look at returns. We tell people don't look at last year because the manager who might have outperformed last year is unlikely to do it next year.
Correct.
Just by the index. But you make a point in the book that I think is really important, and that is we're putting so much energy in the investment performance when you could just be purchasing a diversified portfolio of index funds and doing all the stuff you really should be doing. How is it that that piece gets left out of the equation in the financial services industry? Why doesn't anyone want to really talk about that?
Well, everybody who's ever been a magician knows that the trick of being a successful magician is to distract people's attention from what you're actually doing. So if you look at investment management, it's really interesting and exciting and all kinds of nice things being, and gee whiz charts all over the place, and we're in the top, we got 5 stars, we got 4 stars and all that sort of stuff. Nobody says, wait a minute. Let me look at what's really going on with no tricky stuff. Let me just seriously look at it. If you look at the plain vanilla facts, you can't help but come to the conclusion that today, unlike 50 years ago, it doesn't make sense to be trying to beat the market because there's so many smart people who have exactly the same computing power, exactly the same information, exactly the same time. They're all competing from same identical basis. How can you possibly be substantially better? And I mean 15% better.
And so what we really should be doing is saying, keep your eye on the ball. And the ball is, how do we get you to save more? How do we get you to plan for the future? How do we get you to manage the fabric of your real life so that the investments are serving you, right? That you're really looking at what your goals are. How are you going to put your kids through college? How are you going to reach your retirement goals? Do you see the industry shifting? And there is such a pushback against this concept of fiduciary, which to me was like the boogeyman to the industry. Really, we're the Department of Labor saying, please, please focus on what's important to these people. And the industry's like, no, we don't want to. Is that going to shift?
I hope so, because I think it's really profoundly embarrassing to have the President of the United States stand up and say, we really don't want to see people taking unfair advantage of older people, young people don't know enough, and people just not paying attention. We think that's wrong, and we don't want to see it happening in our country. And other people standing up and saying, no, we need to protect the people who are doing that. Well, you know, why in the world do you want to protect people who are really exploiting the weaknesses of other people. I don't think so.
I don't think so either. And I think that I guess that the argument has so much weight coming from somebody like you, because what you're really saying to us is, I've been here, guys. I saw it when you could beat the market. That game is over. So buy your index funds. Be very clear about what you're doing, and focus on these other important areas of your life,
which are really, really important. We differ a lot from one another. My fingerprint can put me in prison. You can get out of prison because your fingerprint is not mine. Your eye has a different visual so that you can go through customs in many countries automatically because of your eye. We all know our DNA is really completely different. We're just as different as investors.
And that is, that is why there is no cookie cutter approach to your financial life except your own financial life. And that's what we have to focus on. When we come back, one teeny tiny short more segment. That's it. And then I'll let you go. The poor guy's chained to the desk. I'm going to let him go eventually. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. More with Charlie Ellis when we return. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. We're finishing up the hour with Charlie Ellis. And boy, what an amazing stint we've had with you, and thank you so much. Before we even wrap it up, I just want to thank you again. This has been such an honor and a great pleasure. I got the galleys for the book, but I want the real one, and I want some mushy inscription eventually. But
easy.
We'll see. All right,
done.
Great. Charlie's book is called The Index Revolution, Why Investors Should Join It Now. Okay.
Let me emphasize one thing. It's short.
Yeah. It's very readable. I mean, I read it on the plane, on the way down to Miami. So it's easy, right? So a nice,
yep,
easy flight. The index, the freedom that an index fund portfolio will give you is what?
Well, you flew to Miami. How much training did you have for flying? How much responsibility did you have for the timing of your takeoff, the angle of attack, the altitude at which you'd operate? You know, we're very comfortable turning over the operational part of flying to somebody else who's trained for the purpose. And we do the same thing with so many other parts of our lives. And that investment management, there is no reason in the world why we shouldn't turn over the operation to people who are really good at doing it and who are going to do it for best value for lowest cost. That takes you immediately to indexing. And there's no one in the investment management business who wouldn't say, yeah, that's really true, but please don't mention it. The second thing is, when you fly, you have to choose where you're going. And that's really important. And if you get on a plane that takes you to Seattle and you're supposed to meet your family in Miami, that's not a win. So the most important question most people have thought was, how do I beat the market? That's not a good question today particularly. But there is a very good question. Who are you? What are your own objectives? And where do you really want to go with your money? And also, do you have enough? So saving enough is the first and most important step. And then secondly, investing in a sensible way. So here I am in my late 70s. I don't have a very long time to live. So most people would say, oh, yeah, you really ought to have a lot of fixed income. I don't believe that, because in my own particular case, I'm really investing for my children and grandchildren, and they've got plenty of time.
Charlie Ellis, thank you so much for joining us.
Great.
You're fabulous.
To be with you, Jill. Thanks.
Jill on Money. You missed any of this interview, go to jillonmoney.com. We'll see you next week. Thank you so much for tuning in, and send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. See you next week.